Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
And welcome to New Horror Express, your fortnightly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's podcast, I'm chatting to writer-director Fernando Ale about his debut feature, the action horror comedy Mutant Blast. During our conversation, Fernando tells us about the movie's long developmental process, how him and his crew managed to pull off such an effects-filled film on such a low budget, and the challenges of dealing with the film's various tonal shifts in a way that is not completely jarring to the viewer. Plus, he tells us how the movie ended up being distributed by Troma and the reaction the picture has received on the festival film circuit. There's also a whole lot more in the interview, which you will hear in just a sec. But I would quickly like to remind you, if you don't mind, the best way you can support the show and help us get to the next level is to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Radio Public, Spotify, all those places. It would be very, very much appreciated. Anyway, now on to the interview with Fernando. Hello, Fernando. Welcome to New Horror Express. It's good to have you on the show. We're here to talk about your debut feature film, Mutant Blast. So quickly for the listeners, can you give a synopsis of what Mutant Blast is all about?
Well, Mutant Blast is a film for people who are tired of zombies. It starts with a zombie apocalypse and about the ending of the first act. The military, they deploy nuclear bombs to get rid of the zombies, but they create mutants. So halfway through, zombies are an afterthought, and the movie just keeps getting crazier by the minute, you know, by the introduction of the mutants, and there's always crazy things happening, and they are attacked by a giant rat and all types of creatures, and I don't want to spoil too much, but that's my pitch for the movie.
Okay. And yeah, it's having seen the movie, and that nicely encapsulates the film part. What was the initial inspiration for the writing this story? Because you wrote it as well as directed it. So, what was the?
Yeah, sure. There was an evolution while I was writing it, because I've always liked zombie movies, but zombies had a bit of a resurgence in the early 2000s, you know, 28 Days Later, Romero started making them again, and then Shaun of the Dead. But when we got through, you know, a few years ago and in this decade, where there's Walking Dead became mainstream, and I think that horror movies, 10 years ago, we were oversaturated with found footage. I think that now we are oversaturated with zombies. I don't know if you would agree. So while I still wanted to make a zombie movie, I kind of felt saturated by them. And I felt that what do I have to add to the genre? So I thought that I had to do something new with it. So that's why the movie, halfway through, the movie becomes disinterested in zombies. But in the same way, it pays homage to the zombie genre. You know, I say that this movie is my love letter and breakup letter to the zombie genre.
Yeah, I definitely think. Is that why there's like the running gag that like the zombies are like almost a swear word in the movie? It's like bleeped out whenever it's said. It's quite a funny kind of ongoing running joke.
Yeah, it's a running joke. It's I mean, I go back and forth whether I should explain it or if I should act like David Lynch and not explain why I did that. But let me, instead of answering, let me ask you, what do you think it means? Why do you think I beat out the word zombie? When the characters say in the movie the word is beat out, why do you think that I did that?
I assumed that it's just kind of, you know, just going off your comments you just made about over saturation, just fed up of hearing the word zombies.
It was not quite my idea, but it kind of works as well. I was like, you know, in zombie movies, I think that if it's a comedy, the word zombie is mentioned. But if it's serious, the movie is taken seriously, the word zombie is never mentioned by the characters. You know, if you think back to the Romero movies, if you think back to even Shaun of the Dead has a gag about that, because they say the word zombie once, and then Simon Pegg says to Nick Frost, don't say that, don't say the Z word. So it's kind of an unspoken rule, you know, if you think to the Walking Dead TV show, the word zombie is never mentioned. It's like 200 episodes of that series, and it's never mentioned by the characters. I think that the word zombie is only mentioned in zombie comedies. So it's kind That's of a... Yeah. Yeah, so that was basically the idea, to respect the, you know, there's a character in the movie, the main character, the girl, she doesn't consider them zombies, you know. Oh, that's ridiculous, they're not zombies, they're scientific experiments. She's the serious character, and the other characters who say the word zombie, they are basically the audience avatar. That is the idea behind it. But yours also works quite well, so I'm glad it's a gag that even if people don't arrive at the same conclusion that I intended, that they, this is a funny bit. So I'm glad that that's the reaction.
It also reminded me of like the kind of on-running debates that of certain films as well, of, you know, like 28 Days Later, where people say it's zombies and it's not, and some people are like, no, they are, but you know, it's like
I think they are. I think they fall under the zombie category, the zombies in 28 Days Later. Yeah. And in my opinion, it's because if you think, for example, Twilight, where the vampires sparkle and you know, they change the lore, they are still vampires. You know, just because you change the mechanics of how the infection spreads and that kind of thing, and they run, doesn't mean they're not zombies. They're like mindless creatures that were human and are not. So I consider them zombies.
I can see that. I can definitely see that. But I've heard several debates about certain movies, particularly 28 Days Later.
I'll fight to the death that 28 Days Later is a zombie movie.
Zombies. They are it is a zombie movie. Yeah, for sure. No need to.
I disagree with the filmmaker, because Danny Boyle said that it's not a zombie movie. So
I know.
this is in contradiction to the filmmaker. But you know, they say death of the author. You know, as the movie's out there, like me beeping out the word zombies, you give you your own meaning. So the director is no longer in control. So I think that Danny Boyle is wrong on his own movie, on the definition of whether it's zombie or not.
Yeah. You wonder if he would have said that like a few years later when zombies were cool again. Because like in 2002, they were not cool. But, you know, a couple of years later, we suddenly got loads of zombie movies in the mid-2000s, like you said.
Oh yeah, that's true. That makes sense. And to another point for my argument, I think that 28 Days Later was one of the movies responsible for the zombie resurgence. So it should be considered a zombie movie.
Absolutely. But anyway, back to your movie. So your movie took a long time in development. I read that you worked on it for like 7 years. How did the story evolve and mutate? And presumably, it, you know, from the initial script to the finished product, there was quite a lot of changes and mutations, or maybe there wasn't. How did it evolve?
Structurally, no. The structure of the story always remained the same ever since I wrote it back in 2012 or 2013, so 6 years ago now. And what happened was that I had a really, really long pre-production period because I, you know, there's a giant rat that was a lot of work to build, and it's a rat that appears in 2 minutes of the movie. You know, it's crazy. Most movies would have the giant rat as the main villain, and I have in a sequence that's over in 2.5 minutes, and there's a giant lobster, so many other creatures. So it's not like I. The elements were set in stone, you know. We started building things, and some things took longer. So the story structure was always the same. What happened was every year I would sit down and read the script and cringe a lot at the dialogue and change it. And that was a process every year up until the eve of shooting. I would change dialogue, you know. And I had liberty. The actors, they were also involved. We sat down when we were shooting, and we changed lines of dialogue. So that was most that I would say was the changes in the script. Was all about dialogue.
And what was in the pre-production period? What were the kind of greatest challenges? What was the giant rat? Was that the greatest challenge, or what kind of difficulties did you face that you had to overcome over the course of making this movie?
Well, the thing is that I did not compromise. You know, if you I wrote the movie without thinking of a budget, you know. Everything was limitless. Nuclear explosions, giant rats, giant lobsters. And so the screenwriter, the director were the same guy. It was me. But I think that the screenwriter was a real asshole to the director and the producer of the movie, because I wrote without a care in the world for all the complications. And I can't single out any prop, any special effect that was particularly hard, because everything about it was really hard. My main concern in the shooting schedule was I really wanted the movie to have a strong opening. I wanted the people to be to have that feeling, okay, I'm watching a good movie, and then relax, you know, not be on edge. I want to really have a strong opening. So we have this a minute and a half one shot sequence where the main characters are breaking out of the prison complex and fighting zombies. There are hidden cuts, but it's supposed to play as a one long take. And I was really nervous about it. And I had conversations with my DP, and he said, "Don't you want to have coverage? Let's try to do it as a one shot, but let's try to add some shots as coverage just for safety." And I said, "No, let's go all in. Let's risk it." And we are really nervous, but and I scheduled that for the. It was one of the last days of shooting, and we had 42 days of shooting. So we really, I think there was a trial by fire. So we were really prepared for that scene, and I was nervous about it. But when it came time to shoot it, it was one of the easiest scenes to shoot. It was amazing.
That's awesome. I was wondering as well, there seems to be a lot in the movie that, like the discussion we were having about, you know, your feelings towards zombie movies and it being a love letter, but also like trying to avoid the cliches of zombie movies. There's a lot in the movie that kind of plays with expectation. For example, I don't think it's a spoiler to say that there's a character kind of at the start that you kind of think, like, this is going to be like a main character.
It's kind of a spoiler. Let's keep it vague.
But like, okay, so there's a but. Sorry, yeah. Okay,
that to me is the "I am your father" moment.
Okay,
of the movie. That's when we like pull the rug under the audience's legs. It's like, whoa. So let's not go into too much detail. But please continue with your question. Please continue with your question, because I'm curious with the expectations. What were your expectations regarding the movie? So please continue.
Okay. So there's certain setups that you imagine to go a certain way, and they don't necessarily go the way that you'd imagine. Or go in, there's a lot of different elements, and you imagine that it might go down a certain path.
Yes.
A traditional zombie path or an action path, or, you know, but, and it goes down, it does go down those paths, but it goes down various other tributaries as well. And I just thought there must have been like a conscious thought of like playing with audience expectations and assuming that the audience might think that the movie is going a certain way, and then deliberately taking up a left step from that.
Oh yeah, sure. I think that I am delighted by the thought of an audience member going to see the movie and thinking, "Oh no, another zombie movie. I'm tired of zombie movies." I even had this week someone saying that I revealed too much in the trailer. Someone that hadn't watched the film. And I said, "You have no idea. You have no idea how little this trailer reveals." And it's completely on purpose. There are so many movies in the world. You know, you have to make something different. You know, why are you telling the same story? So it's on purpose, and it's on purpose the cliches on the beginning that you see, and you see the. You think that you have seen these characters. You think that, oh, this is Terminator, this is Sigourney Weaver in Aliens. You think you know what these characters are, and that's the starting point. But of course, it goes to several other places, and of course that was a concern, because I really feel proud of this movie, and I think that's like a movie that's like there's never been anything like this. But that's not necessarily like a good thing, because before Sharknado there was never a movie about sharks in a tornado. That's not something that you have never seen before, is not necessarily a sign of quality. So that was a worry that I had, because the movie starts, if you show the film to someone and you stop at the 10-minute mark and you ask them what happens next, you ask 1,000 people, no one will guess how the movie will end, because it's such a wild journey. But it could not work out. It could really, you know, there are tone shifts, and there are elements that are introduced that are weird, like a giant lobster. So that was really a concern, that all the escalation that happens in the movie be gradual, that the audience is always on board. So I really thought about, you start the movie serious, the main sequence in the prison complex is serious, there are no jokes. Then we cut to one of the other main characters who's hungover from partying, then the comedy starts to reveal itself. And slowly, we go to this crazy place, you know, in the halfway through, when the characters meet the mutants, I worried, how am I going to introduce a giant lobster? Is this going to hold together? You know, I don't know, what's your opinion? You seem to like the movie. I've shown it at several festivals, the reaction is always the same. People laugh at all or at the right moments. So I think that the film has been successful. But I'm curious to know what did you know about the film? What were your expectations when you were watching it?
I have to say, I suppose I did have a certain thing in mind when I watched the trailer. I'd seen the trailer. I'd heard some things about it from Fright Fest, and so I knew it was a kind of a bit crazy. Yeah,
and that's how you heard about the movie at Fright Fest. That's
Fright
how you
Fest, found out about it. Through Fright Fest is how I heard about the movie. Yeah, so I suppose I had maybe a certain thing in mind. That's kind of that's maybe part kind of zombie movie. The trailer almost made me think a little bit of, I don't know if you've seen the kind of Asteron 6 films. Which is also released, that one wasn't released by Drama, just Father's Day. Manborg. And I was kind of thinking, oh, okay, this is a good zombie, isn't it? Maybe it's a bit like that as well. It's slightly comic. But no, I couldn't have predicted. I don't think anybody could have predicted the territory it grows.
And not only the territory, because I think that the most surprising thing to people is the dramatic and emotional elements in the film. You know, people say I was not expecting to cry at the end, and they do. It's amazing. They may expect, you know, a silly comedy. That's what they might expect from the trailer. They are never expecting those emotional elements and all the themes about the place of humanity in nature, you know, and all that ecological message, you know. So yeah. Nobody's expecting any of that.
Yeah, that does seem kind of stuck in it. I think that was one of the biggest surprises to me, of like the kind of, again, I don't want to spoil anything, but the kind of environmental message that kind of comes in the towards the end of the film.
Yeah, sure. And it's kind of funny because I showed it in Mexico, and the film has incompetent leaders in the military. The main villains, they're incompetent. And someone asked me a question if it was like a critique of Trump and all these, you know, Boris Johnson, all these stupid leaders that we seem to be electing. And it's like the script was written 6-7 years ago. I couldn't have predicted that, but since the movie is coming out now, people also give meaning to that, and that's not something that I originally intended to have meaning. You know, it was just played for laughs.
Yeah. I suppose, given the current situation of the, you know, the current climate of the world, the political climate, it does give the kind of incompetence of authority figures that extra.
Yes, definitely.
What?
Sure. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, that,
sorry.
No need to apologize. No, I was.
There is a slight delay.
The one of the things I liked is there's a lot going on in the movie. But the tonal shifts and the genre shifts happen quite fluently. Now, I've seen a lot of movies that are crazy and have weird tonal shifts, and they come out of nowhere and they can really throw you out of the movie. But this doesn't happen in this film. I watched it and I enjoyed it, and it didn't happen to me. I think they happen quite fluently. Yeah. So, what to your mind was that the kind of slow escalation of events? That, is that how you kind of mapped out to make those transitions not throw viewers out of the film and be like,
yeah, it's like it's really hard. You don't know if it's going to work. You know, you just have to have faith. I did have some concerns, and I took extra steps, you know, to make sure everything went smoothly. Because like the first 5 minutes of the movie is completely serious. It's like an 80s sci-fi movie, Terminators. There's like maybe a little bit of Resident Evil. So we get out of that world, and we are introduced to one of the main characters who's just a normal guy who has no special powers. He's just hangover, and he wakes up, and there was a zombie that killed all his friends in a party. So we have the element of the comedy introduced, and it keeps getting crazier and crazier. And the thing that I had most concerns about was the giant lobster. You know, you are 45 minutes removing, you are accepting a lot of stuff, and all of a sudden a giant lobster shows up. How do I sell this to the audience? So I really agonized over this. So the way we shot it, we took our time to introduce it. It's not like, bang, there he is, you know. The character wakes up, he starts seeing all these weird creatures, and then he sees a giant lobster. And there's the soundtrack that plays over that is a throat singing Tuva from Mongolia. And it has an ethereal quality, you know. It's like out of this world. So this helps. It's like I'm signaling the audience, yeah, we know this is weird, you know. And the character is finding it weird, you know, the audience is finding it weird. And all that scene is filmed with wide-angle lenses. So there was a care for there was a lot of consideration for not to fuck it up, you know, because if and I'm sure it's subjective, you know. I'm sure that there are people that will see the movie, and no movie is perfect to everyone's eyes, you know. I'm sure people will say the opposite of you. Oh, to the tonal shift, it threw me off. But so far, the response has been very positive. People have said the same thing, that the tonal shifts are very gradual, and it works for them.
And in terms of audience reactions, how did audiences react to the giant lobster? Because again, I don't want to give too much away or say too much about it, no, about that character, but in the end, I would say the giant lobster is one of the highlights of the film for me. I was wondering how other people have reacted to that character.
If you go to Letterboxd, do you have Letterboxd?
Yeah.
And people post reviews, or people have seen it at festivals, and it's like the giant lobster is the main highlight of the movie. He steals the movie. You know, we have seen people, the critics who have seen it and wrote reviews, they just say that it steals the movie. There's just recently, two days ago, someone posted on Letterboxd, Jean-Pierre, which is the lobster character, is the best character in the history of cinema. You know, this fills my heart with joy. You know, there's another one here that says Jean-Pierre the Lobster Man is the funniest thing I've seen in my life. You know, it's been a success. You know, people really, really, really love it. I'm glad. It's like almost halfway through the movie, it's almost like he becomes the main character, and it's really quite special, you know. If you think back to iconic characters, people say that Darth Vader shows up in Star Wars the first one. I think like in the whole original trilogy, he shows up like for 25 minutes, something like it's insane. It's like we have no. I swear, it's like in A New Hope, he shows up for 11 minutes, and it's like the total runtime is really, really small. And I think that it's the same with the lobster character. I'm not wanting to compare to Darth Vader. I'm just saying in the terms of the character, you know, staying with people, that it's like in just a few scenes, you know, he just shows up halfway through the movie, and it steals the movie completely, and people are in love with him and are invested emotionally with the character. So I think that's been the feedback, you know. It's been very positive. People love the characters, especially the Lobster Man.
And what's your favorite character to write, just out of interest?
Oh, that one. That was the one. That was Lobster Man. Yeah, definitely. Because there were moments I would write the script that it would be like that scene in Seinfeld when George and Seinfeld sit down to write a script. I don't know if you
yeah, I'm a Seinfeld fan.
Yeah, they write like the character enters and says good morning. Okay, let's rest. So that's me writing. I write like one sentence. That's good. I need to reward myself. I'll watch TV a little bit, you know. And the moments I was writing Jean-Pierre, especially that moment that you I think that you'll see that generally it's the one that draws most laughs, is the when he has a monologue, you know.
Yeah.
I think you'll know the scene. And when I was writing that, I was like possessed by a spirit. It's like I was frantically writing, you know, the words simply came out really quickly, and I'm a slow writer, you know. I'm always questioning the sentences, and I put a word, then I delete the word and think, what other word can I use? I procrastinate a lot when I was writing that scene, especially with Jean-Pierre. It's like I was possessed by Tarantino, who was like writing vigorously, you know. So I think that's a good sign. And his monologue was almost completely unchanged ever since the first draft, if you can believe it. That almost all of the script, the lines of dialogue went through complete changes. Sometimes I would reread things, and I would like, oh my god, this is so cringeworthy, and you make it better, but that one stayed the same all the way through, almost all the same. Some very very minor changes.
Talking about the script, and you changed the dialogue in conjunction with the actors and stuff. How did the actors initially react to reading this script and all this craziness?
Well, everyone loved it, and everyone had the same question. How the hell are you going to pull this off? You know, because this is a $20 million script, you know, in terms of the value of the production. You know, it's like, how are you going to pull this off? And so it's not like anyone didn't understand or didn't like. People found it funny, but they had their concerns. You know, they didn't want to. You know, everyone in the team was very perfectionist. You know, and that's why the movie took a long time to make. So I'm not going to say that everyone was 100% on board and believing, but you know, after the first day of shooting, you can see the smile on people's faces, and halfway through, I really felt, you know, the crew, the whole crew, the whole the actors getting really really excited about the film. You know, feeling that okay, this is really something special. Because the you know, halfway through the shoot, we were editing at the same time we were shooting, so we would shoot the scenes, and they would see that the how things would go, and things would go well, but then we'd show it edited, and people would be really impressed with the results. So, but I'm glad that they trusted, because it's a really big trust, you know, because it was a really really complicated process.
And I was wondering as well, because some of the actors, you know, went back and forth with you on a dialogue, and it seems like you're not a dictatorial director. I was also intrigued by the fact that at the end of the movie, usually it says a film by, and it's just the director. But
yeah,
the end of your movie, there wasn't. There was a number of the cast, as well as your name, there. And is that why you felt the need to to do that?
Yes, definitely. It's like, that's my communist manifesto, you know. It's like, we have to kill this idea of the author. Of course, I was the one steering the ship, you know. But it couldn't have been made without those 15 people that show up at the end of the credits. I would cringe if at the end it showed a film by Fernando Alves. It would be not fair. You know, I really felt that we were shooting, and you know, the main actress would suggest a line of dialogue, or it's not even that. You know, people were really working towards the movie with love. Not, they were not like there for money, because there was no money. So I really couldn't have done it without them, and I really feel that it's our movie, it's not mine. You know, it's like I wrote the Jean-Pierre character, but the actor, he was the one who brought the soul into the character. If you think, for example, there are a couple of shots in the film where the lobster is not the Joinville, is not the actor, it's standing, and I feel the difference, you know, and just think, oh, it's just a guy in a suit, you know. You think that it doesn't require much acting, but it does, you know, the body language it requires, and you know, and the people put a lot of effort into the movie, you know. They really worked hard, and I don't agree with this author theory. It's bullshit when it comes into films. It's like there are so many accidents, you know, all throughout the history of film. It's like, if you think back to Raiders of the Lost Ark, when Indiana Jones shoots the swordsman, you know, oh my God, what a great script. But it was not a great script, you know. It's like Harrison Ford was sick, and they came up with that gag just so they don't have to film a sword fight. And that's the community feeling with the entire crew and cast. That's what brought the happy accidents. That's what brought the film as it is, you know. I can't claim the film as my own, because the actors gave it soul, the composer gave it soul to his music. And I think that music is very important in film. You know, what is E.T. without its theme? What's Raiders of the Lost Ark without John Williams' music? You know, so actually no one had ever asked me that before, so thank you for asking. And that's something that I would like to do with every movie, you know, to dispel this idea of the author. I kind of hate that.
And I absolutely agree with that. I mean, like, filmmaking is a collaborative process, and there's, like you say, there's so many kind of iconic bits of movies that have little to do with the director. You know, Ridley Scott's a brilliant director, but the most iconic scene in Blade Runner is Rutger Hauer's monologue that he did himself.
Sure, yeah, the Tears in the Rain, he ad-libbed that, yes, of course. And you come out of the film and you look at the screenwriter, and that's it's like, of course you're not going to create a credit for a line, you know, that line created by Rutger Hauer. It doesn't make much sense, but it's kind of unfair, you know. I think also the ending of Chinatown, it was, I don't remember who, the line, forget it, Jake, is Chinatown.
Yeah,
I don't think that was in the script. I don't know who came up with it.
No, the guy, it was Robert Towne who wrote the script, but no, I don't think it was in his screenplay.
Yeah, definitely. And one of my favorite scenes in the Mutant Blast, it's like, my favorite scenes in Mutant Blast are the character interactions. It's not the gore, you know. If you are in for the gore, you'll be satisfied. There are plenty of head crushes, plenty of decapitations. But my favorite scene in the film is when the characters are eating a duck. They're around the fire eating a duck. And that's the moment where they really bond. And what happens in that scene, they start laughing, you know. But that was not in the script. So what happened was the actor who plays the character who has a lot of limbs coming out of his body, he started eating the duck, you know, very not gracefully, you know. He had so we started laughing, you know. And then we started laughing, and I said to DP, okay, turn the camera, film her laughing, No, more laugh. And I started laughing, you know, let's laugh. And maybe I'm a good director in terms of seizing the moment, you know, seizing an opportunity, but I didn't think about it. And it's like, if that was not in the script, what would be the movie if it were not for that scene? There was the scene of them bonding, you know, missing, you know. It's like we needed that scene, and we sold it as an accident. We sold that scene, you know. That's the scene where the characters really are okay. We're in this together. We're bonding. Everything is fucked up, and it's like it didn't exist. And it's my favorite scene in the whole film. So I it's like it's really a collaborative effort, you know. It's like it's like when you build a building, you know the name of the architect and maybe the engineer, but no one cares about other people who are important in making this building last stand. And that's what I feel about film. It's really unfair because it's really a collaborative effort. Yeah. You know, if I write the book, it's my words. Maybe there's an editor, but I really think that in films, it's really important and really really unfair how much we look up to directors. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. So the film was is distributed by Troma. How did the relationship with Troma come about?
Well, I had a short film playing at a festival in Spain, and Lloyd was there, so we exchanged contacts, and they distributed my shorts. And I just sent them an email and said, well, would you give me some money to make a feature film? Barely did I know that it was not enough money, that you really needed much more money. But they were the first financiers to come on board. They gave, they gave ideas, they gave notes, some I took, some I did not, you know. And later, in 2015, you know, 4 years ago, I submitted to the Film Institute, the government. They give money to filmmakers, and they approved the film. So the film is state funded and has the Film Institute is famous for, you know, financing maybe more dramas or more artistic movies. That's something that you would not, you know, regularly associate with Troma. And I think that speaks to the strength of the script, that they went for it. They saw the script and they took a chance. But so Troma's relationship was that, you know, they were an ocean away. So, the whole.
So you don't feel that they interfered too much or could interfere too much?
Yeah, of course. It's like, I would have meetings with Lloyd on Skype, and, he would give his notes on the script. And it's like, if they were good ideas, sure, I'll take it. If they were not, I wouldn't, and there's nothing they could do about it. It's like we are an ocean away. Luckily, they are very happy with the film, so all is good. But it's not like, fortunately, I'm not in a situation. It's like those stories you hear where the film was taken away from the director and it doesn't have final cut. No, it's like, no, this is my final cut. Here it is. It's like I have the hard drives, I have everything. So, fortunately, you know, how would they not be happy with the film? You know, it's really great and it's been doing great at festivals. So there'll be no reason to not be happy. And but I really took some notes from them. You know, but it's like you get notes
about everything, you know, and you have a vision, you know. Sometimes they're not bad notes, but I have a vision, and I'm, and you have to control your ego. You can't think, oh, I'm the director, how dare you suggest I do this? No, you have to listen, you know. And so that's what I say. It's a collaborative effort making a film.
And it's interesting as well, because it does fit in quite well with the kind of trauma films. And
don't you think it's like a really, well, a weird left turn for them? It's like, for example, there's no nudity in the film.
Well, that's very true.
Yeah.
I felt like it fits in a way, because it's got a mixture of splatter gore, comedy, horror, and a line in social commentary, which quite a few trauma films do. I mean, the lack of nudity is a big difference to your regular trauma output. And
that was one of the notes that I refuse, you know. It's like, let's have some nudity in here. And I said, sure, right, yeah, I'll do that. And then I kind of forgot to include nudity in it. And I think that it stands out because of it. And I feel that the film also, yeah, it's kind of it has that craziness, you know, of the maybe of trauma films, but it's like I feel that if you were to make if you were to cut the film to be appropriate to smaller audiences, you could, without, of course, you would ruin the film, because every type of censorship is horrible, but it's like you wouldn't ruin the story, you know. You could, it's not essential to the film, you know, the violent bits and all of that, you know. So that's the way I kind of feel it differs also, you know. It's not there's no offensive humor, there's no menace in the film, you know. It's like all the violence is against zombies or monsters. So that's what I would say. It's like the two main differences.
Yeah, I would also say in tone as well, that I suppose there is a difference, because you were talking about that scene where they're all sitting round and they're eating a duck, and it's kind of a bonding moment for the group. And I would say there is a warmth to your film that,
thank you,
quite often, like, there's you know, there's not the kind of nihilistic streak that you might get with quite a few trauma type films.
I completely understand. Yes, and of course it's like for me, the more, of course, trauma was a direct influence, but I was more influenced by Peter Jackson and Terry Gilliam, and it sounds weird to say, but it's like, it's even influenced by Werner Herzog, you know. So there are a lot of influences in the film that go beyond trauma. And one of the things that you were talking about, tonal shift. Mm-hmm. There are tonal shifts in the film, but it's like, the film never does not take itself seriously. You know, it's not like a scary movie comedy. You know, it's like the characters are always serious. The music is always serious. We never wink at the audience. You know, so I think maybe that also helps with the tonal shifts. You know, that it's not a spoof movie. You know, it's like everything here is serious. We're taking this seriously, even though it kind of is silly, you know. It's a giant lobster with a suit. But I think that's what's funny, you know. I also love the scene where they are talking about life, you know. And it's such a serious dialogue and a serious music. It's like it's almost like out of an Ingmar Bergman movie. But it's a mutant with lots of limbs coming out of his body and a giant lobster in a suit. So that's where the funny is, in the absurd.
And that was also a kind of a deliberate choice. It's almost like that airplane thing, where we know we're watching a comedy, there's lots of gags, but the characters don't think they're in a comedy.
Yeah, sure. I think that if you have a funny situation and you have an actor trying to be funny, you know, trying to out funny more low-key, sometimes it's better, you know, sometimes it's more funny if it's like a funny situation and the characters are taking everything seriously, you know. So that was my main note to the actors, you know, this is serious, we are doing the drama, you know. It's like, don't try to be funny, the situations are already funny enough, they're already absurd enough.
Was that also something you were thinking about? Because, like, I think there is a lot of movies that are probably in a similar milieu to your film in a way, in that they take a lot of influences from 80s film, but they're very knowing about it and kind of almost parading, like, oh, here we're referencing Terminator. Oh, here we're referencing Evil Dead 2. Sure. Aliens.
That's what I hate. It's like in horror movies where it's like Detective Romero, Miss Craven was murdered. It's like, oh my God, it's so cringy, you know. It's like the references have to be subtle, you know. It's like it's like an Easter egg, you know. If it's you shouldn't stop the film to do the reference, you know. And I think it succeeds at it, you know.
It also insults the audience intelligence, because, like, I can see that there's films that have influenced your film, but you've not told me that. You've just allowed me to see that. You've not kind of pointed it out to me and been like, oh, in case you're an idiot, we're referencing this.
Yeah, sure. And it's weird. It's like, it's a thing that's almost exclusively to horror films, you know. It's like you don't see too much in low budget action films or comedies. It's like it's really a thing specifically to horror films, and it's silly, you know. It's like the influences should feel organic. It shouldn't be like, oh, let's reference it, and it's like, okay, yeah, you know about it, and now what? What do I do with it? You know. There's a dream sequence in Mutant Blast that a character is dressed like Ash from Army of Darkness, but I feel it's very natural, you know. It's like we don't dwell on it. It's I think that's the most reverential moment in the film, maybe, you know, when we're referencing other films. But of course, I'm influenced by plenty of films, and you'll find lots of elements that, if you ask me, yeah, sure, I'll say, yeah, definitely. It was influenced by Die Hard. I was influenced by Terminator, definitely. Terminator was definitely an influence, you know.
Is that your kind of, I mean, obviously, it is got quite an 80s flavor. Is that your kind of favorite time period in terms of action and horror? Is it just that you've decided to make this particular movie with an 80s flavor?
Oh, I wouldn't say it has an 80s flavor. It's more like it is an 80s recipe, but I added my own flavor. Because if you think about, like you said, the films of Astron 6, Man Borg, and the editor and Father's Day, they are very reverential to the period, you know. And I really wanted to make my own thing, you know. I was raised on all those films, you know, 80s and 90s action films. But if, for example, the scene where the main character meets all the other mutants, there's that music, the throat singing. I lifted that from Little Dieter Needs to Fly, which is a Werner Herzog documentary about a prisoner of war in Vietnam. So that's not a thing that you you would think would be an influence, you know, a documentary, an influence on this type of film, you know, and it is. So everything is an influence to me, and I watch all types of films, you know. I don't have a favorite genre, and as long as it's good, I want to see it and I like it. And so that's why I think that the film is not very reverential to 80s movie or 80s action movies. It's my own stamp. That's what I feel it is.
Yeah, I was wondering, like, you mentioned the kind of Herzog influence. Is it the, I mean, obviously he is another person who makes quite crazy films that often have different tones and genres in them. Is that how you feel it influenced the Herzog thing?
Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely, it's like I'm influenced by all those filmmakers. That it's like I'm not a fan of rules in cinema. You know, rules are meant to be broken, and Herzog is not a filmmaker who follows the rules. You know, he's not a filmmaker bound by story structure and the first act and second act and for that, you know. It's like if a film doesn't, at this point there should be a turning point, who the fuck cares? No, as long as it's good, it's like the audience will be on our side, you know. So if I had to describe the film, that's what I would say. I would say in paper, it sounds like an 80s low budget film. But when you see it, you'll see like it's almost like an 80s film directed by a Nouvelle Vague director, you know. that's what it is. I feel that it's very, it has very... artistic elements that you wouldn't normally put in a film.
Yeah. It actually, in some ways, it reminded me that there's, I interviewed somebody on a very early episode of the podcast called Gershus Gerdner, who he directed a movie called Pazuzuz, The Island of Vomit and Desire. And it kind of reminded me of that in a way, because his influences were like, he was a Brazilian filmmaker, and his influences ranged from like Coffin Joe to, oh, I can't remember, I suddenly lost the name, the Polish director who directed the horror movie Possession.
I know.
I know, it's kind of weird, and people like Herzog and stuff like that as well. Kind of brought to mind of that a little bit. And it's interesting because, you know, like, just because you're making a horror movie or an action horror or whatever, doesn't mean you don't watch, you know, you just stick to your genre ghetto, as some people might imagine.
Oh, no, definitely. It's like, and I've met directors who don't like cinema, you know, they're like, it's like they stopped in the... maybe 90s, and that's cinema history for them. You know, it's like I watch all types of films. You know, I love musicals. You know, it's like it's every genre. It's like I make absolute no distinctions. You know, and of course that happens when you have a director who likes everything. You know, if you have a director who only watches horror films, you'll have a more limited vision. You know, it's like of course it's like and if you think back, for example, to Paul Thomas Anderson, you know, it's like if you think that's like he's more of an auteur, he only makes dramas and artistic movies, and Paul Thomas Anderson even said, "Oh, I don't do blockbusters because nobody offers me to make them, but I like them." You know, he was even attached to direct. I think he was attached to direct Pinocchio movie for Disney. I'm not sure if it was for Disney. So it's like you know Terrence Malick loves Zoolander, you know. So I think that there are some sometimes we put filmmakers in a box, and you know, there are always surprises.
I would absolutely agree with that. And if you get a particular tag, whether it's a horror tag or a kind of arty auteur tag, you know, you do get kind of hemmed into that box. And people often forget that there's like weird moments in Paul Thomas Anderson movies quite often. Like the weird musical number in Magnolia where the cat start singing, that Amy Mann song.
Yeah, definitely. Yes. And those are very risky moments. It's like also the frogs raining, you know, it's like there are no rules to cinema. It's like it's whatever we want to make. And I'm attracted to that. And I think I kind of, it's like maybe this film can be a gateway drug for for more weird films for people, because on the surface it looks like an 80s action horror throwback, but it's something much more. So I'm really hoping that those influences. I'm very glad that you picked up on it and enjoy those elements, you know, and about not being put in a box. That's one of the reasons why I want to make something completely different, you know, as my second film. You know, it's people are always asking me about the sequel. It's like, this film is only at festivals, it hasn't even been released yet. It's like, I feel I'm pregnant here. Mm-hmm. I'm still pregnant with it. And if people are asking me about the sequel, I don't want to think about a sequel to Mutant Blast. I don't think I want to do it. And even if I did, maybe a few years from now, you know, next project, it has to be something different. It has to be a drama or a more serious sci-fi movie. I have a couple of ideas, but nothing concrete yet.
Well, that was going to be my final question. Was going to be like, what's next? If it was just continuing the journey of Mutant Blast at festivals and again a proper full release, and what the next film? But like, I did pick up from what you were saying there that you didn't want to just make the same type of movie, just make another necessarily make just another horror comedy. And also, just quickly, just for the listeners, Andrzej Zalowski is the director of Possession.
Yes, that was the name. That was the name. I should have Googled it while we're talking. Yes, but I want to make a. I have an idea for a film, but it's like for me to think about it. Just have to hope that Mutant Blast is a success first, because it needs a bigger budget. So I have an idea for an actual martial arts film. So, and something serious, no comedy at all. So completely serious. So let's see how it goes. Let's see how Mutant Blast goes. It's going to premiere in cinemas here in a month from now, 17th of October, and hopefully at the end of the year, beginning early next year, is going to be in all the other countries.
Excellent. Well, I enjoyed it, and I recommend it to my listeners to check it out when it does get a release here in the UK or wherever you're listening to this from. And it's been great to have you on the show, Fernando.
Well, thank you very much. And to your listeners, please give us a like on Facebook and or follow us on Instagram, Mutant Blast. And I really hope that this interview has people really curious about it. And thank you for giving me a platform to promote it. Thank you very much.
That was my guest, Fernando, there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. And as always, thank you, listener, for tuning in. Before we head on out of here, I would like to quickly remind you, if you enjoyed the show, the best way you can support it and help us grow is to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and Radio Public. That is all for now, but be sure to join us again in 2 weeks' time when we will have another ace guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya!